Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Zatarain's, a New Orleans tradition since 1889. WWNO New Orleans and our studios in the Southern Food and Beverage Museum, this is Louisiana Eats. I'm Poppy Tooker. This week, on the cusp of Carnival, the traditional big meat celebration before the Lenten fasting begins, we're hosting our own meat celebration. But instead of the traditional fatted calf, the bouffe gras, we're celebrating the cochon gras because we are all about the pig. We'll visit with Isaac Toops of Toops Meadery to experience the excitement of watching an episode of Top Chef at the restaurant's bar. That's where Isaac sees himself on each week's show for the very first time. Then, because Whole Hog Cookery is an all-night affair, we'll join in a sleepover at the Southern Food and Beverage Museum with Dr. Howard Conyers, who's both a NASA rocket scientist and a barbecue fanatic. Finally, we'll have a lively debate on the ethics of eating meat with Corby Kummer, senior editor at The Atlantic. It's Carnival for Carnivores on this week's Louisiana Eats.
Have you ever heard yourself in a recording and want, I sound like that? Oh, God, really? That sounds horrible. Multiply that by 100 and you have yourself watching yourself on TV. It's unnerving. I wanted to throw up the whole first episode. I had to get drunk. I was drunk by the end of the first episode at my own bar. Man, it's like, okay, time to go. I'm fine.
That's what Isaac had to say on our first segment about his participation as a contestant on this season's Top Chef. Once we knew what Isaac was doing on Thursday nights when the show airs, we could not resist joining him at the restaurant for a recent viewing. Despite the driving rain, Toops Meadery was teeming with diners. We joined Isaac and his wife Amanda at the bar with a clear view of the television.
Oh, God. I've never won immunity. I think the best part about it is that I know that I can go all out tomorrow and do whatever I want.
Look how beautiful that oyster shell is. Isn't that gorgeous?
Isaac, welcome back to Louisiana Eats. I'm so glad to be catching up with you just like I dreamed right here in the restaurant on viewing night. So, how you feeling?
I'm feeling great, Poppy. Let me just say, I wouldn't stop shucking oysters for anyone except you. So, no problem.
Well, I have to tell you that my first experience in the restaurant during a Top Chef airing was last week, and it was absolutely electric in here, but you were working so hard that the restaurant was operating at max capacity. I remember at one point you weren't even sure if you were going to be able to come out the kitchen and watch yourself. There's so much noise in here that if it weren't for the subtitles, most of us would be missing what was going on. But the one thing that I simply did not miss was really and truly how tough this obviously is on you personally.
It is really tough. It's tough on everybody. We had some top-tier competition. I mean, everybody on the show, I mean, especially the top 10, once you get down to those people, everybody's nearly either their own chef, a James Benner Award winner, a Food and Wine Chef of the Year. They were all top-tier talent. Everybody was smart, and everybody adopted different ways of approaching it. And my way of approaching was just like, hey, you're here. Give it all you got. The babies are at the house. The restaurant's in completely on the other side of the world right now. Go kick some ass and show them what Louisiana can do.
I could just tell that everything you were reliving, every misstep, everything you wished you had done differently, it was weighing on you so hard as I watched you and Amanda sitting at the bar, and all I could see was your back. And, you know, you're sitting next to him. It was very different sort of body dynamic because your arm was around him. It was clear, like, that you were like, okay, you can lean on me about this. How does it feel from your end?
You know, it's a little bit like getting your skin scrubbed off every week, you know, and you feel naked for a second, and then you go, and you get to put it all back on. You put your armor all the way back on, and you go, we got this, we can do this. You know, people say things, but Isaac and I do live by the mantra that if you have haters, you're doing something right.
Yeah, they run into the Whole Food Market again and again on Top Chef.
I ran in so fast one time, I ran into the doors before they had time to open. and they tell us, it's like, okay, you have 20 minutes to shop. You have 30 minutes to shop, but don't run real fast and run people over. Well, I like to clock the mini a grandma.
You clocked many a grandma.
No, I almost did.
Watch out, grandma.
Watch out, mama. Mama. coming through. Entree, boo. 17 minutes. Atrás, I was on your back. And every time you run in, especially sometimes it was a new Whole Foods, sometimes it was the Whole Foods you've been a previous chance, but you still run in and going 20 minutes, shop, and sometimes you have an idea what you want to do, and sometimes you don't. And that's the weird part. So you got to go, I have this idea. I want this protein. You go there, It ain't there.
They need to come up with a dish that represents who you were 10 years ago. So what were you guys doing 10 years ago?
Well, next week we take a little more of a somber turn. You know, we do a 10-year challenge. Or 10 years ago, what were you doing? And at the time of recording, 10 years ago, I had to do the math. It was 2015 at the time of recording, and we're going, okay, 10 years ago was 2005. What happened in 2005?
10 years ago.
What else happened?
That would be Hurricane Katrina.
So as soon as they said that, I was like, well, there's nothing else I can even think of that happened in 2005 that would be worth mentioning. And, you know, I tell the story of, like, you know, we all evacuated. A bunch of my family lost their houses. And we all moved back to homeland, Rain, Louisiana, where my parents had this big, huge house. So all of a sudden, there's 30 coonasses living in a house, living in the shed in the back, in a little green room and whatnot. And so we're packed in. We go, okay, we need to feed everybody. Okay, well, what do we make? We start going back to the old school, big batches of gumbos and stews. And it's like, well, we pull out some ducks out of the freezer, and we made a big batch of duck and sausage gumbo. And I thought, it's like, that's what I'm going to make. You know, I hadn't busted out gumbo yet. I was waiting to pull one of my guns. And so I end up making duck and andouille gumbo in 2 hours for 12 people. And so I make duck gumbo. I make my own charisse. I make duck cracklings. I make crispy jasmine rice cakes. I make duck stock and then blend the duck stock with the dark roux in 2 hours. That's... damn, you're amazing. Damn, you're amazing. If I don't say so myself, the judges were impressed, and especially Michael Voltaggio was like, I make gumbo. It takes me 45 minutes to make the roux. And I'm like, yeah, sure does. Yeah.
It's really delicious. I would love a big pot on the stove because it's such a communal, feel good meal.
The sausage was done really well. The casing for me was tough.
All things considered, really, really good.
They really bust you on what you call something.
So really?
You call something a salad, best be a salad. You call something a soup, best be a soup. When you have a multitude of talented chefs, they've got to point out something. So it's like, this is good food, but you didn't follow the directions. So sometimes it's the challenge. So sometimes, like, everybody cooked really good food, but now we have to go on the challenge rules.
So, you know, I got knocked a little bit. You know, I don't know if they'll say it, but Tom was like, yeah, it's very brown, which I wanted to slap everybody at the table. I'm like, a lot of Louisiana food's all brown. No one gives a shit. It's good.
Yeah, so it's very hard to photograph our food. We all know that.
Yeah, I was just saying, you know, and I did run into that on occasion, not to mention me being colorblind. I don't care about the color of the food. Like, yeah, it's not very colorful. I'm like, go bugger yourself. Did you taste it? Taste it. Oh, this is really good. Yeah, who cares about the color? You don't care about the color of my food after you've eaten it.
So every day, that a day in Isaac Toop's life must open up a new door. So you're working on a cookbook project.
Yeah, we're working on a cookbook project. That's been in the works for a little while. That's been pretty nice. I've never done a cookbook. You've done some cookbooks. Maybe you can help me out with it. Of course, people want, everybody's calling me up and wants a little piece of me. Hey, will you come to this? Will you come to that? And I'm like, yeah, will you pay me money? No? Okay, I'm not coming. No, I'm not like that. But people come out the woodwork, you know, all of a sudden they're on your show, and like, you get 300 new friends on Facebook, and people go, hey, you met me from high school? And I go, yeah, I hated you.
Well, I'm so glad I was friends with you before the show.
Exactly.
And you can guarantee I'll be in that number, because I'll be eating your food right here at Toots Meadery, no matter where you are in the universe, Isaac Dukes. Thank you.
You're very welcome, Poppy. Anytime for you.
Inspiration for this dish comes from the place that my dad and I were going to.
Isaac Toops of Toops Meadery and contestant on Bravo's latest Top Chef. Get out your jammies, because when we return from a short break, we're going to have a whole hog sleepover with Dr. Howard Conyers. Stay tuned.
I can take it, I can't take it anymore. Can't take the heartache.
I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats. Edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Rouse's Markets.
This world is big and wild and half insane. Take me where real animals are playing.
The Southern Food and Beverage Museum recently hosted a very exclusive barbecue event. 10 lucky participants got to spend the night tending the whole hog barbecue with Dr. Howard Conyers, a South Carolina barbecue expert who's a real NASA rocket scientist by day. Robert Moss, contributing barbecue editor for Southern Living magazine, was in attendance, and he got the evening rolling.
I'm Robert Moss. I have the title contributing barbecue editor for Southern Living, which sounds a lot fancier than it is. Basically, I get to travel all over the South eating barbecue and writing about it, so it's a pretty good assignment. And I've never really been able to satisfactorily answer where barbecue really came from, because people have been roasting animals over fire for many years, in all cultures, from Europe to Asia, and certainly Native Americans were drying things. But Southern food culture is really the coming together of European, African, and then Native American traditions. And all three cultures sort of had a history of smoking meat and came together. The word itself seems to come from here, but the technique is, I think, more of a blend of those three cultures. South Carolina hog barbecue is a special thing. It's something that almost disappeared from the landscape, but it's starting to notice it. I think we have some plans to maybe go to Texas and try to, evangelize a little whole hog out out west of Mississippi. So I do think the future of whole hog barbecue is still, there's a good bit of hope, and I do think that it's going to continue to revive and come back. And I think events like this are a great way for people to sample it and learn a little about this thing that really has been going on, not for 50 years, not for 100 years, but literally 300 or 400 years in American history. It's truly one of the great legacies of Southern cuisine and American cuisine. How about a big round of applause for Howard Conyers?
Next up, Dr. Conyers. Here's what he had to say about the tradition of whole hog barbecue.
Welcome all. Thank you for coming out today. I know you all could have been doing a lot of other things, but I really want you all to really get a hands-on, really touch and feel what South Carolina whole hog barbecue about. What is South Carolina barbecue to me, not being in the restaurant industry? When I think about South Carolina whole hog barbecue, I think about fellowship, family, friends, church, resourcefulness. Most of the pits we use today comes from means that we didn't have anything, or we used basic building materials to help build the pits that we need to cook whole hog. A lot of people think of just South Carolina barbecue as just simply pulled pork, vinegar, or just simply mustard. And it's more than just vinegar and mustard. I could cook pulled pork in my oven if I let it cook long enough. Also, with the barbecue sauces, you have four recognized bases in South Carolina. You have vinegar, which is the oldest. Then you have mustard. You have light tomato, a heavy tomato. Those are the four most popular ones. laborious, why is it very labor intensive? 12 plus hours of cooking time. Last night we started around 10 o'clock cooking this whole hog. Yeah, time to make barbecue sauce into that equation. I'm cooking with all wood. And when I mean I'm cooking with all wood, I take this device here called a burn barrel, but it's just a tool we use to make the embers to fire underneath the whole hog throughout the cooking process. And the slaughter time, back in when I was a child, we used to slaughter pigs before we barbecue them. So you have to add all those hours into cooking a whole pig. So expensive, pigs are not free. So if you got $4 a lecture, $4 a pound, if you got a 100-pound hog, that's $400 before you get started. So you're spending $250 to $400 just on the meat before you even start cooking the first ounce. And then you add another $100 or so for the wood, you've been anywhere from $350 to $500 to cook a whole hog. And you'll wonder why this tradition is dying. It's for that mere fact, a lot of people can't sustain that kind of economics to just pay for cooking a whole hog anymore. So I said, why the tradition is dying. Farmers, small farmers are going few and far between. Education, those of us who probably grew up in the rural environment, we often leave and we choose other things for our career and passions. It's hard work, the cost of it, and for younger generations, people my age, just a lack of interest. And when did I recognize this barbecue tradition was dying? In 2013, I participated in Halls for the Cause here in New Orleans. And I was one of a few teams that had a burn barrel, a pit, and cooking a whole hog using Carolina methods. And now that really when it hit home for me that it was dying. And then I started going back to South Carolina and I started seeing people I knew cooking whole hogs, not cooking it anymore, whether you went to Boston Butts. And that's what it really resonated like. If somebody don't pick it up, then it's gonna die. I mean, I dropped it off for a long time. I've been cooking whole hogs since I was like, I've been around it since I was probably like 6 years old. I've been around it really all my life. And I cooked my first one around age 11. So is it dangerous? Yes. Is it child labor laws? We have to let that go. Cooking, the engineering, the art. I know I said it's South Carolina barbecue, the STEM, but it's also an art form. I probably make it more of an art form than actual science exercise because I don't use any thermometers to keep temperature right. I use the human body, which is probably one of the best technological inventions in the world. I use the hands, the nose, the ear, and the eye that make South Carolina barbecue. If y'all can find any devices better than those, let me know. The end. This is short and sweet. Anybody want to go outside and take a look?
Once we had a taste of Dr. Conyers' barbecue, we decided to travel up to Shreveport for a taste of what our friend Carolyn Simmons was smoking at her restaurant, Blue.
I am fascinated by meat. I don't, you know, other people want to go to the grocery store and buy all pretty and nice and groomed. I want to get the biggest, hairiest piece of meat. And I say hairy because I love a live animal that I have to butcher down myself. And I want to take every piece of that meat and look at it and say, what should this be? You know, I love the term nose to tail because I think I was nose to tail before I ever heard the term. And because I love meat, I grew up in a Southern Baptist, very conservative family where I kept saying, Dad, let me grill. And he said, no, told my brother, Chuck, get over here. You help me grill. So I started teaching myself how to grill when I was in my mid-20s, and I started burning meat, just like I talk about burning food. I'm an avid reader, and I read every book on barbecuing, and I talked to everyone I know. Then one day, I read about smoking meat, and I thought, this is pretty darn cool. So I bought a little aluminum pan, and I was soaking wood and putting wood in it and kind of setting it to the side and figuring out what to do with it. And my love of smoking meat grew into the fact that now I get to do it for a living, which is a pretty amazing thing.
So
So what are some of your smoked meat dishes that you feature at your restaurant, Blue?
One thing I like to do, I like to get the full chuck, you know, the big 25-pound, and I cut it up, you know, depending upon what it's in the mood to be that day. And whatever I have left of it, and usually I have about 12 to 14 pounds left, I have a coffee rub that I put espresso coffee on, and I rub it with this, and then I always catch my renderings when I smoke meat. So I take all my beef renderings from the day before, and I inject it, and I let it sit there and come up to room temperature, and I smoke that. And that's what I make into my chopped beef, and that is the best chopped beef sandwich you will ever taste. And then also I grind my own sausage, and you know I do a lot of pork, and there's a lot of fat left over from pork. So I use some of my extra, you know, your renderings. Whenever you're cutting up meat, there's always pieces you cut off and you think it's waste. Nothing is ever waste. It's sausage. So I take that sausage and I smoke it. And if I have breakfasts, and I do a lot of catering. So when people get a catered breakfast from me, they're getting all my scraps from all my meat. And we're not wasting anything. And then I smoke it in my smokehouse, so it's nice smoky sausage.
Do you have a preferred wood that you smoke with?
Oh, definitely. I feel very strongly about wood. We have a lot of local hickory here. So when people cut down hickory trees, they know I'm constantly searching for hickory. They'll bring me, I've got a guy who cuts it up, they'll bring me their hickory. So I try to use only Louisiana hickory. And then in Mansfield, there's a pecan orchard, and they have all these leftover shells after they shell their pecans. So I use their pecan shells. I sometimes use applewood and things too. I bring in a little bit of wood that's not local because some things I want to be a little more delicate. But most of my meat is smoked with local Louisiana hickory and Louisiana pecan shells.
Sauce, the eternal question. You've already told us about your preferred rub.
Right.
How do you feel about sauces?
Well, I love sauces. They're so much fun. And like I bought some Hatch peppers the other day. So guess what sauce I'm making tomorrow? I'm going to make a barbecue sauce with Hatch chili peppers in it. You know, to me, things should change seasonally. And I think right now we've got these great peppers, so my sauce changes. I do put my renderings back into my barbecue sauces. And then I used to put molasses, but I found that there's a company just across the border in Texas. So, you know, I try to only use Louisiana but you know, sometimes you got to use Texas products. But they don't extract their molasses out of their sugar. They leave it in. So it's a really dark, rich sugar, molasses sugar. So I put that in all of my sauces. And then we have a local brewery here called Great Raft, and I use their dark, rich beers that I put in my sauce because I think you got to put beer in a barbecue sauce.
I like beer in a barbecue sauce too. All right, here comes the $1 million question. So obviously you know how to win a contest because there's that James Beard burger thing that you came through with so successfully. Have you yet entered the world of competition barbecue?
Well, you know, it's funny. I have a close friend and she owns a restaurant called Herbie K's, and she calls me up and she says, you know, in 3 days there's a barbecue contest here in Shreveport. Why don't we enter it? And I had never even been to a barbecue contest. So 3 days after deciding it, she calls me up. She says, well, they said that it's too late to enter. But then I called the person who's organizing it, and when he found out who wanted to be in it, he said we could do it. So we've never been to a barbecue contest. We set up, we go over there, and a lot of what I do is international. So I thought, well, if this is a contest, I should do something, you know, my unusual foods. So I made an al pastor pork, which is a pork that you put on a rotisserie. And you have it full of, you know, fresh pineapple and everything. I made that for my pork. I made Korean barbecue ribs. I made an Italian brisket. I thought I did great. All the other chefs were like, wow, we've never tasted anything like this at a competition before. And all the other chefs were eating my food, and they were so excited. Well, I came in third to last place. I found out American barbecue contests don't want foreign food. So that's my only competition, but we had fun.
Okay, way to go, girls. So here's the throwdown. I see you at Memphis in May, Hogs for the Cause, just up the game and let's see you in those big competitions, all right?
That's a great idea. And next time I'm going to read the rules and find out how they want the stuff done. So I will win next time.
Okay. Can I be on your team?
Oh, wouldn't that be fun?
Yeah, yes, let's do it. Thanks, Carolyn.
Thank you so much.
Barbecue experts Robert Moss, Howard Conyers, and Carolyn Simmons. His boundless knowledge of Southern culture, John T. Edge is also an expert on quintessential American foods. Whether it's donuts or hamburgers, fried chicken or apple pie, John T.'s knowledge about food is always insightful and engaging. Today we're talking with John T. about the contemporary barbecue scene and how this food historically extended across racial lines in the segregated South. The story of barbecue is really an illustrative American tale of food and race. Tell me how you sort of started along that track.
Well, you know, I guess like any good Southern boy, I begin by saying, well, when I was growing up in middle Georgia, I rode my bike to a barbecue joint a half mile from my house, Old Clinton Barbecue. And I love that place. In part because my family had a charger count there and I could go charge a sandwich and an orange crush and a Brunswick stew and not have to pull money out of my own pocket. I love the food there. I still do. But I realized later in life after I went back to grad school, after I learned to look at my place at the South with open eyes, I learned that I didn't know who cooked that food. I knew the white folk who stood up front and took the money and handed over the sandwiches. But I didn't know who the men were who labored out of sight at the pit. I didn't know who chopped the wood. I didn't know whose labor resulted in that great sandwich. I only knew Miss Coulter, who stood at Old Clinton with his cleaver in her hand, chopping the shoulders, chopping the hams.
Even after the Civil War, often a white man might be credited for his talent at the pits when it was really the labors of that unacknowledged black man, huh?
There were some really poignant dispatches. One was from the Federal Writers Project, a 1937 interview of a former slave named Wesley Jones of Union, South Carolina, who recalled in the antebellum era that he would stay up all night cooking and basting. And he talks about mopping the meat with a soft rag wrapped in a long pronged stick. And in later years, he told the story of a couple of lawyers that came to watch him cook. He said he cooked whole hogs and whole goats. And he said, the lawyers like to watch me anoint that meat. And that, to me, is at the heart of this. You know, there is a reluctant admiration and a reluctant acknowledgement of that former slave's work by these presumably middle class or upper class lawyers. But that's rare, you know, this idea that they thought he had a talent for cooking. It's rare in the historical record that we see whites acknowledging the work of blacks.
Well, one of the things that I found very illuminating was how barbecue began to be a way out of poverty for African Americans.
Cooking barbecue by the roadside in an earthen pit was a path towards self-sufficiency for black men and, to a lesser degree, black women. You know, there are tale upon tale of digging a pit, chopping down trees, making, you know, ad hoc charcoal, and in essence, using your wit and using your muscle by the side of the road to earn a living and leveraging that into a small business. And from there, opening another business. You know, there are people like Lawrence Craig, who was a famous barbecue cook in Devall's Bluff, Arkansas. his restaurant still exists in that small town. And Mr. Craig talks about starting on the side of the road with nothing more than an earthenware pit and a piece of corrugated tin to slap on top of it and selling sandwiches and starting that way and then working and working and working until he owned his own business.
James Jones of Arkansas's Jones Barbecue Diner is another great example of that.
Yeah, Mr. Jones, whose place in Marianna, Arkansas, in the Arkansas Delta, may be the oldest black-owned family restaurant in America, if a firm date could be established. It's probably between 1900 and 1910 and is in its third generation and going strong. But his grandfather said they called his place the hole in the wall, and that's just what it was, a window in a wall from which they sold meat that was piled up in a wash tub. And from those beginnings, that family, generation after generation, has made a living and has created this space in Marianna, a town hit hard by poverty, that is, from my travels, the bright light in that town. You know, the reason one would detour off the interstate for Marianna, you know, is solely that barbecue restaurant. And it's a place where you see black and white making pilgrimages. You see rich and poor making pilgrimages. You know, and they value the labor of that family, of the Jones family. And to me, that's one of the few arenas in which black and white often show respect, and they show respect across the dinner table. They show respect across the counter at barbecue restaurants, and Jones is one of those great places where that happens.
Well, the world of barbecue is having a bit of an evolution now, isn't it?
It is. I think right now barbecue is hip. There are at least three shows on the various food networks and travel networks that celebrate barbecue, and yet that to me is problematic because most of the attention that the popular press and especially the various cooking and food network shows, they're focusing upon the competition circuit wherein middle class white guys like me are the focal point, the kind of person that instead of buying a bass boat, they decided to buy some jerry-rigged cooking apparatus. And they're the people that are now defining excellence in barbecue. They win a trophy, and they are celebrated. This is something I argue about fairly often with a good friend, a guy named Brett Martin. And, you know, Brett says that all boats rise by way of this attention on these competition pitmasters. But I think we're losing this great opportunity wherein these aged pitmasters in their 60s, 70s, 80s, they may finally get their due. They may finally get their moment to kind of step to the proscenium when America's paying attention to barbecue. And instead, the camera turns on these middle-class guys for whom barbecue is a hobby, for whom barbecue is an avocation, not a vocation. And I think that's wrong-headed.
Do you ever eat barbecue in Louisiana?
Yeah. There's a great place called Grayson's up, way up, around Natchitoches.
Mm-hmm.
I remember going there because they had both pork and beef on the pit, and at least the time I went, the pork was situated in such a way that it dripped onto the beef and flavored the beef, which I thought was a condemnation of the beef. But I also remembered that they served their barbecue on what they call frog buns, which was their way of saying French rolls.
That's hilarious.
Yeah. And the place was genuinely good. When people decry barbecue in Louisiana, I point that place out. And I found other good places back when I was wandering about in Shreveport. There was a place called, I think it was Blue Moon. Mm-hmm. They had great ribs. I mean, barbecue in Louisiana, good barbecue in Louisiana are not mutually exclusive terms.
Are you trying to tell me that the closer you get to Arkansas and Louisiana, the better the barbecue gets?
Oh, you said that, Poppy.
John T., thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us on Louisiana Eats.
Thanks for asking me.
John T. Edge, food writer and barbecue fanatic.
Hot barbecue! Thank you.
How does barbecue sauce differ from state to state? Stay tuned. And when we come back, we'll take you along on the Southern Barbecue Sauce Trail.
Hot barbecue!
I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Rouse's Markets.
Everywhere there's lots of piggies living piggy lives. You can see them out for dinner with their piggy wives.
Here's this week's culinary quiz question, brought to you with support from Popeye's Louisiana Culinary Institute. How does barbecue sauce differ from state to state? Vinegar, tomato, and mustard are the elements that all define regional barbecue. Vinegar-based sauces are essentially refined basting liquids, the origin of all barbecue sauces. In Lexington, Kentucky, they prefer a vinegar and pepper-based sauce with tomato paste or ketchup to thicken and sweeten the vinegar base. In the mid-20th century, tomato-based sauce became the American standard, a runny, sweet and sour sauce with a kick of pepper that dominates Memphis and St. Louis barbecue. As 20th century barbecue marches on, commercial tomato and sugar sauces take on a life of their own. Unfortunately, as they really overpower the smoky meat. South Carolina is also known as the mustard belt. That's because they prefer a sauce much edgier than their tomato-based cousin. The intense concoction of yellow mustard, vinegar, and seasonings is South Carolina's choice for saucing whole hog barbecue. No matter which sauce you prefer, barbecue cooked low and slow makes for some good Louisiana Eats. Now that your mouth is watering over all those barbecue sauce choices, you could probably use some recipes. Let's review the Carolina barbecue sauces. In North Carolina, it's all about the vinegar sauce. It's a simple combination of cider vinegar, crushed red pepper, black pepper, and salt. When we travel south, mustard sauce reigns. South Carolina mustard sauce combines yellow mustard, honey, apple cider vinegar, brown sugar, Worcestershire, and hot sauce. Mix those ingredients all together, and then refrigerate the mixture for at least 24 hours before saucing anything with it. The mustard sauce can stay refrigerated for 2 weeks, so keep that barbecue party rolling. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats. Corby Cummer is one of the most widely read, authoritative, and creative food writers in the U.S. He's been referred to as a dean among American food writers and is the winner of 5 James Beard Journalism Awards, including the M.F.K. Fisher Distinguished Writing Award. Here, Corby weighs in on the topic of meat ethics in the 21st century. So give me a little bit about Corby Cummer's point of view, to eat or not to eat meat, because you have written so much on the topic, you've read everything, and consequently, you know about the influence of the power of the pen, yours and that of others. So tell us about that.
So the power of the pen is so great that I decided it was time to read a number of new books that have come out dealing with the question of industrially raised animals and just how terrible it is for the animals, the environment, and the people. I think that we're all kind of aware all the time, if we eat meat, that this animal has been killed for our dinner. and we have to deal with the consequences of that with our own conscience. But the books I recently read, because they've come out in the past 10 months, one is called The Chain by Ted Genovese, and one is called Pigtails by Barry Estabrook. Both deal with pig farming, and I think that a number of years ago, there were enough books about what it was like to finish cattle on corn and how bad it was for their digestive system and how many antibiotics they had to eat, that we all switched to grass-fed if we thought we were going to eat beef. But pig farming hadn't had the same kind of investigative reporting treatment that Genovese and Estabrook in their two new books have given it. And so it was really interesting to read the two next to each other, even though they came out about 6 months apart, because Genovese in The Chain writes a tremendous amount about what the effect is on the workers. The workers at a Hormel plant who are forced to try to keep up with production line speeds where pig carcasses are flying by them, and they have to try to do the same repetitive cuts one after the other. And the USDA authorizes the Hormel plant in one of several tests that are just horrifying tests to determine the speed by itself. So the Hormel plant decides we're going to go faster and faster, and it's worse and worse for the workers. So Genovese talks about the toll it takes on the workers, and Estabrook more on the animals themselves. So they both make side-by-side kind of horrifying reading.
What I loved about the Estabrook's contribution to this is how much he humanizes pigs. And it amused me to death. It's so Corby Cummer to me that you actually, during this experimentation, you went to lunch with a lady and a pig at the Four Seasons in Boston. I really don't know anybody else who's accompanied a pig, a real pig, to lunch.
Right. Well, this is my friend Patty Marks was writing a piece for The New Yorker about therapeutic animals and how much could you get away with if you went on the internet, phonied up a letter saying you had the need for therapeutic animals. And she did kind of ridiculous stunts like wearing a pet lizard into a fancy handbag store that sold lizard pocketbooks or taking a therapeutic turkey to Katz's Deli in Lower Manhattan and ordering a turkey sandwich. And so she was bringing a pig to Boston mostly to find out what it was like on a plane to see what the airline personnel would do with it. And, you know, pigs are so darned cute that what they did with it was all of the flight attendants demanded selfies with a pig. And it was my idea to go into the Four Seasons. And after the woman at the check stand looked at the letter and said, okay, I don't think I'll get into trouble with my manager, let us in, a waiter sort of raised an eyebrow as we were going in. And I said, you ever seen one of those in here before? And without missing a beat, he said, not on 4 feet.
Oh, that's wonderful. So the bottom line with pigs are they're smart, they're charming, they're adorable, and if you really got to know a pig, you might have a hard time eating it, huh?
Well, the thing about what Estabrook does is he kind of sets up the reader, because near the beginning of the book, not quite at the beginning, he leads us to this incredible pig that is so intuitive. It understands the sentiments of its owner, just the way we think of dogs. It's incredibly emotionally intelligent. It could practically be a cut-rate therapist. And after you know how empathetic and intelligent pigs can be, you are very hesitant. And Estabrook has a really deep love for the animals, and so he's particularly outraged at the stories of abuse in these production lines. Genovese is giving us the overall picture of what the whole industry forces everyone in it to do, including factory owners. And to Genovese's credit, he's not just outraged at the abuse within these horrible kind of death chambers where pigs are raised in the darkness and gestation crates. He's also sympathetic to the overmatched workers who are unable to keep up with their chores. And he understands why they take out their frustration in physical abuse, even though he and we are very angry about it. They come out in somewhat the same place as to whether you should eat it or not. Genovese is kind of silent on the issue, and it turns out he is very careful about where he buys pork and meat, but he does eat it. And the same thing with Estabrook. At the beginning of the book, he says, my partner, and we probably both know his partner, the wonderful Rux Martin, a cookbook editor,
yes.
She asks him when he's first thinking of writing this book, does this mean I can't eat bacon? And he says, no, that's not what it means. And so by the end, he's bringing us to farms that really set a terrific example of sustainably and humanely raising pigs. And so we all come out, these two authors and I, at the same place, which is you are really careful about where you buy meat and making sure that you know the farmer, you know how that animal was raised. Then the problem was I happen to know a writer named James McWilliams and his website, The Daily Pitchfork. He's an agricultural historian at San Marcos in Texas and also a really committed vegan. And he wrote a book called The Modern Savage. He's very aware of what it's like for all of us foodies who think that we can kind of get around the queasy-making question of whether we should eat meat by being careful about where we buy it. And he says, all you foodies who think that you're completely circumventing that Hormel horrifying speeded-up production line system by going to a local farm and buying a pig that had lots of good sex and wonderful life while it was being raised, you have the same blood on your hands as if you bought from Smithfield because you have made an animal die for your dinner who didn't want to die. He really takes no prisoners. And so even by the end of it, I think I come to the place that a lot of people come to, which is, yes, I am a moral hypocrite. I am going to live with my hypocrisy and live in the fond belief that I have power in my purchasing power, that I can buy from farmers who exemplify the standards I believe in, and I will try to change the system one purchase at a time. And to raise my own hopes and maybe the hopes of the reader, I go through a list of the large companies that have announced or actually enacted very important gestation crate reforms and cage-free chickens, because eggs is another really important and horrifying example. And it's big and substantial, and maybe people don't understand that McDonald's has been the leader in this. They don't just announce, they do. And a lot of other places announce, and then you sort of don't quite know about the follow-up. But McDonald's has been the leader and the example in this. And it's because consumers have brought about the change. And I believe there is power in the way we buy our food.
Well, Corby, thank you. And for goodness sake, let's eat soon, huh?
I can't wait. Thanks so much, Poppy.
Corby Cummer, James Beard Award winner and senior editor at The Atlantic. That's it for this week's edition of Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Join us next week when we celebrate Mardi Gras in Louisiana.
In years past, we would go to the Milan and just load up on Jell-O shots. But,
so now I you know what T says. Shots T says immature. Shots are stupid.
Jell-O shots are not stupid.
Okay.
Warm shots of bourbon are stupid.
Subscribe to our podcast. Hear today's show or catch up on previous editions anytime online at itsneworleans.com. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen, Rouse's Markets, and Zatarain's. Additional support for Louisiana Eats is provided by the Shreveport-Bossier Convention and Tourist Bureau and by Tableau, Dickie Brennan's latest restaurant serving local Creole cuisine with a view of Jackson Square. Original theme music by Johnny Sketch and the Dirty Notes. Big thanks to producers Joe Schreiner and Sarah Holtz. Come visit us anytime in our Louisiana Eat studios at the Southern Food and Beverage Museum. I'm Poppy Tooker. Louisiana Eats is a production of WWNO and the University of New Orleans.